We've got another fun guest on right now. He just walked into the studio, and that's Lou Pignole. And Lou is a resident of Hovland, beautiful downtown Hovland, but he's come from Minneapolis. He taught chemistry. He was a professor of chemistry at the University of Minnesota for something like, gosh, it was like 38 years.
38 old? Years, yes.
That's amazing. Yeah, and but you've been up here a while. You started building a cabin, I think, some years ago.
Yeah, in 1979.
Wow. Yeah, I didn't even realize that you'd lived here that long until I read it.
They were weekend trips, you know, the long weekend, and having to go home. A lot of people have been there.
Sure.
Well, we moved up in 05, and it was very weird. My wife and I looked at each other and said, "We're not going home." We sold our house in the city, so it was...
I bet it was a good feeling, though.
Yeah, it was great.
And but, since that time now, since that you've retired and you've been here, and actually probably a little prior to when you actually moved here, you got excited about wood, and particularly things you can do with a lathe with wood and creating a very basic tool, which is a wooden bowl.
Yeah. I actually like wood from when I was a kid. I worked as a carpenter in high school. Mm-hmm. So those things you get are in you, but, you know, doing chemistry, teaching, doing research at the University of Minnesota, there wasn't a lot of stuff I could do with wood. So I always wanted to do that. And that was part of the thing moving up here, just to start some kind of a wood working project. And in Hawaii, I saw these wonderful bowls. All that tropical wood, beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I just fell in love with it. I met a wood turner there who got me really turned on. Came back here and took a class at North House Folk School on a spring pole lathe. And that's really my entryway into doing this. Because right after that, I bought a lathe, started working in my garage. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. But I was starting to turn. And I just pretty much learned by trial and error and calling my friend in Hawaii, getting advice. People at North House. North House is such a great resource up here. Mm-hmm. And so that really helped me.
Can you tell us, explain what a spring pole lathe is for the folks out in the audience that wonder, now what's that?
Yeah, and I don't use that anymore. I was just
that was your introduction to
it. It's a lathe where you pump with your foot, and there's a rope that goes up to a pole, and it has tension. So you spin the wood both ways. You can only turn when it's spinning toward you. So you really have to know how to hold the tools to turn with that kind of a lathe. Mm-hmm. So it's a great way to learn. But the kind of stuff I do now with burls and very large 25-inch bowls sometime, you really couldn't do on that type of a lathe. That's a traditional Scandinavian lathe for, you know, the course I took at North House was called Norwegian Ale Bowls. And we drank ale out of it when it was done. So I don't make that kind of bowl anymore. I mean, I like to make really exotic things that take a long time and are really challenging.
You know, we talked a little earlier about when WTIP started in 1998, I believe. That's about the time that North House began. I think these two institutions have kind of grown up together.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many stories like what you're telling us about people who were able to grab on to an art and just go with it.
Yeah. There's a lot of people that retire up here. And I think a lot of people are struggling to find out what to do. I'm lucky because this went well for me and people started buying my bowls. I could pay for my hobby, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's a lot of classes at North House and people who are looking for something to do, just start trying stuff. I think all of us have down deep inside something we really wanted to do all our life and never had a chance to do.
And, now these lathes that you talked a little bit about describing a spring pole lathe, you bought a power lathe.
Yes.
What kind of tools do you need to make that work? And maybe you can describe how you actually do that with this piece of wood.
Yeah, you don't need a lot of tools. That's one of the reasons that this was something I could do without. If I was going to make furniture, I'd have to have a lot of different tools. So you need a lathe, which basically spins the wood from a spindle and it turns the wood, then you use a handheld tool like a gouge to carve the wood as it spins, right? So you don't need a lot. You need to cut your tree up into a bowl blank. I just use a chainsaw. So you could actually get by with a lathe, a chainsaw, a couple gouges, which where you can do almost everything with the gouge. There's a lot of fancy turning tools, but you know, I think they're mainly for marketing and making money for companies. Mm-hmm. You don't need all that stuff. You just need a few gouges, maybe a scraper to get a finer cut, and then just some imagination and creativity. The nice thing about doing it is when it's like throwing a pot. You got this thing, chunk of wood spinning in front of you. With potters, it's clay, and you're shaping it with a handheld tool. And for me, I want to bring out the beauty of the wood, the grain. That's why I like to work with burls. That you just see it emerge, and the shape of the bowl is dictated to me by how to make that wood really come out. If there's a interesting knot, I want to keep that in the edge of the bowl, so I'll work real hard to do that. And it's just the interactive process, and it's you know, you're really in the zone when you're doing it. The world stops. I can do that all day. It is fantastic. I feel lucky I've discovered this, and people are buying bowls all over the world, actually, on my website. You know, so I can buy, I have three lathes because I'm teaching at North House bowl turning, you know, artistic bowls, the kind I make, which requires some background. But, you know, and I've got classes full all the time. So, coming back to North House to teach is great.
Now, there it must be different densities in these different woods. And how do you adjust for that? Is the speed have to change, or the tools, or how you hold them, or what? How does that work?
Yeah, it's all done by feel, you know. Some wood is harder, some is softer. You know, my stuff is very unsymmetrical, so I can never spin at a real high RPM because the lathe would start walking around the shop. So I start pretty slow, and, you know, I have to sharpen the tools very often. For the harder wood, the tools get dull. Burls, the wood is always hard, and the grain is all over the place, so the tools get dull. I'm going to do a lot of sharpening. But, you know, the sound is different. Different woods sound different. So, I never play a radio, not even WTIP, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. What I'm turning is because, you know, if anything's going to go wrong, and with a lot of wood, they can fly apart on you, the sound will always tell you that's going to happen. And, you know, it's a little danger because things are rotating 500-600 RPM. If a piece flies apart, you know, it can hit me. It can go across the room and I've had it go across the room. I haven't been hit yet. But the sound will, you know, is really important. And the type of wood sounds different. Each type sounds different. So you get used to that.
So you really have to be in the zone just to know, just to have a feel for what you're doing.
Exactly. You really do. It's sort of all your senses are focused. When somebody comes into my shop unannounced, my son always gets annoyed at me because you know, I'm listening and so focused. I hear the door open and I jump, you know, almost break what I'm doing. And he says, well, what can I do? How do I warn you? You know, I need to set up an alarm system, I think.
Yeah. How did you get, you started out with just wood, but how did you transgress into, or how did you evolve, not transgress, but evolve into burls and...
Yeah, well, I guess, the wood turning came really easy to me, and I just love a challenge. I mean, it's problem solving. That's really what you're doing, because every bowl is different, and I'm starting to turn bowls that are very unsymmetrical, and most of the turning is just, the tool isn't even hitting the wood, because it's spinning around and there's air. And those are a little scary to do the first time you do it. But I you know, every year I just get some crazier, gnarly pieces of wood, and I just love doing that. Mm-hmm. I'll dream of it at night even. Say, I'm going to go out there today. I'm going to turn this piece I've been looking at for 4 or 5 days. And, you know, it's a real challenge. That's what I like. I mean, because you got to evolve and grow. Mm-hmm. People order sometimes just like salad bowls, and I hate making salad bowls. There's no challenge. And, you know, I'm doing just what I want to do. You know, I'm selling bowls to pay for my toys. I don't make any profit doing this. But I can buy lathes and I can teach. And, you know, it's just a wonderful way of exciting, meeting people, you know, the whole thing that really pays off.
Now, you brought in an exquisite bowl that we have sitting here in the studio. And that was made out of cherry. And it's hard to believe, looking and feeling that it started out being cut with a chainsaw.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of work.
Things happened.
Yeah, so you carve it with these gouges, and it's pretty rough. But if you're skilled and you have sharp tools, you can get it reasonably smooth. Mm-hmm. A lot of the traditional bowls are never sanded. I sand my bowls because that really brings out the wood. And I'm really doing this to bring out the beauty of the wood and preserving it. And if you didn't sand it, that, you know, especially with a burl, you wouldn't see all of that dimensionality and the grain figuring. So I spend more time sanding than turning. Sanding is not fun. It's sort of like waxing a car and 20 times. it's just something you do, and that brings out the beauty, and that's the motivation for doing it. And then I oil it, and I sand it again, and then I wax it, and I buff it. You know, there's just a long process for each bowl.
Yeah, I felt the inside of that bowl, and it feels like, I mean, it's so smooth. It's just amazing. And that would be a good time for your son to come into the studios when you're sanding.
Yeah, well, yeah. The sanding, this is part of the issue with sanding. It's dangerous. You know, you're making all this dust from all these woods. Some are pretty toxic.
Oh.
So part of the money I make, I've spent on a very elaborate system to remove the dust as I sand. So I wear a big space suit almost, a big respirator with the filters in the back, and I have one up on the roof filtering. Then I have a hood in front of me that's sucking air into another filter. So, you know, it gets really expensive to have all of that equipment. That's the downside of this, where you really do need to. I wasn't doing that for a while, and I'd wake up at night, sawdust on my pillow, you know. and, you know, I could feel my lungs not healthy. Yeah. So, I spent probably a few thousand dollars just like that to get the equipment, you know, get the air clean. It makes a big difference.
We talked just slightly about burls, but I know Dick and I were talking a little bit off air before you came in, and I spent my whole life in the woods at various times. I've never seen burls like I've seen on your website. Yeah. There was one black ash burl in there that's huge.
Yeah, it was 6 feet by 4 feet.
Can you tell folks what a burl is and how they happen on a tree?
Yeah, well, everybody's probably seen them, especially on spruce trees. They're pretty common, the burls on spruce trees. They're not very interesting to turn, unfortunately. The best idea is that a tree, as it's growing, has some irritation, probably from a fungus, insect, and the tree then says, this is not what I want to have in me. I'm going to grow stuff around it to try to isolate. It's like a pearl in an oyster that comes from an irritation in the oyster. So the wood starts growing around it, and sometimes you see a tree with a 4-inch branch that has a basketball-sized burl on it. It's just amazing. And it's sort of diverted the energy of the tree to growing this burl. And the nice thing about burls, the grain grows rapidly and randomly, and you get different figuring, bird's eye figuring. You get chatoyance, which is this cat's eye glow. You get curly figuring. A lot of this is used in musical instruments, and you've all seen them on tables, you know, these old tables with beautiful figuring. That's all veneers from burls. My problem is I get one bowl out of one burl.
well
but not that one. That one I got a lot out of. But, I mean, most of the burls, I get one bowl.
You mentioned earlier that you sell these bowls all over the world. But you've also been fortunate enough to display at least some of your bowls for royalty.
Yeah, it's funny. The King and Queen of Sweden were visiting the American Swedish Institute, where, by the way, on July 18th, I'm doing one of the very few vendors selling my bowls down in Minneapolis.
Oh, okay.
July 18th, Saturday, all day. So ASI, American Swedish Institute, selected, I think, about 7 of my bowls to put on the table where the King and Queen sat. And a really big aspen burl bowl was right in front of them during the
whole.
Unfortunately, you can't take pictures of this sort of thing. This is royal. I don't know why they don't want. Maybe it's too commercial, right? But I have a picture of the table with the burl, with the bowl on it, but not with the king sitting there.
Yeah. So anybody could have made that up, I guess, Dick, is what he's saying.
That's right.
Yeah. Do you have to worry much about the wooden bowls cracking?
Yeah, this is, I keep my shop really pretty humid. I think there's a lot of control. Some woodturners have built kilns to control the drying. So when you turn, I turn most of my bowls green. And another plug for North House, in October, there's a, what is it? I wrote it down somewhere, October 20-something, there's a Fresh Cut Symposium on green turning. I'm going to give a demonstration there on turning a green burl. But anyway, green means that it's a fresh cut piece of wood, and that wood's going to warp and change after you turn it. So, you know, I have a bowl like this one. I turn it. Obviously, this is radio. You can't see it, but these guys can see it. And that can ease. And cherry is a wood that really likes to crack. So you have to control the humidity, and I really watch it. One of the tricks of the trade is to use a cyanoacrylate resin, which is super glue. And you
really?
If you see a crack starting, it usually starts on the edge, just hit it with a drop of glue, and it completely will stop. You know, so, but that means I've got to watch it like a hawk for about 2 weeks. After a couple of weeks, if it's going to crack, it's going to crack right away. Some pieces of wood have a death wish. They're going to crack whatever you do.
Oh.
And you can't stop it. But I have very few bowls crack now, and I really watch them. Yeah, go ahead.
How you taught chemistry, as we talked about earlier, at university level U of M for a long time, 38 years. How does teaching this art differ from working with your students all those years?
Yeah, well, teaching is teaching. I think a lot of the same techniques you use. Teaching shouldn't be telling people what to do. It's to guide them and let them discover on their own. So when I teach wood turning, just like when I taught chemistry, I'd try to guide the students. I'd show them a little bit how I do it, and then I watch them, and they teach each other and learn. The big difference is the students I have up here are really motivated. I don't have that 30% of the students who are taking this course because it's a requirement for being a doctor, right?
Uh-huh.
Which is a little frustrating when you're at the university. You spend a lot of time working with these, trying to motivate students. I don't need to motivate the guys taking my wood turning class. They are totally motivated, and several of them are now selling their bowls and competing with me, which is sort of the ultimate form of flattery, which I think is great. but the teaching methods are really very similar.
Mm-hmm. Where, you know, we can look at this bowl, this beautiful work of art, a bark edge bowl that you brought in, but people can't who are listening right now, but they can if they go to their computer.
Yes.
How can they find you?
Well, I have a website. It's my name, Lou, L-O-U. My last name is hard to spell, so it's loupignolebowls.com. My last name is Pignolet, so it's Loupignolet bowls.com. But if you just do a Google search for bark-edged bowls, I'll come up on the front page, so that might be easier.
Yeah, and not only will they be able to see your bowls, but they'll be able to keep track of what you're up to and when they can see you here locally.
That's right. I have a lot of information on my website, how to turn. There's a document in there, everything you want to know about turning. Pictures from my classes, picture of the bowls for sale. So you can learn a lot from my website. It's a big website if you really look at all of it. And I spend this is the other part of doing a craft like this. If you're trying to sell, you know, I don't need the money. I'm not doing this to make a living. There's a lot of young artists around here who, you know, are doing their art to make a living. And that's really hard. And an important part of being successful is the marketing. I spend half my time taking photographs and writing on the website. And you have to work your website. You need to have people link to it. And it's just, you know, there's a lot of ways you can get your website to show up in a search. And a lot of artists don't want to do that. They just don't want to spend the time to do it. And it's something that I think is incredibly important if you're going to sell your stuff. You can't make much money at these local art fairs.
No, and if you can build the most beautiful thing, but if nobody knows about it.
That's right. My high-end bowls sell in Europe and in Texas and California. I don't think I've ever sold one in Minnesota.
Oh, really?
You know, which is kind of strange. Huh. But there are art collectors. So, a lot of my bowls are very affordable, and they're not. But the really big burls where I spend weeks working on and have to buy the wood to start with, those get pretty pricey. But if you can put it in front of people who collect art, you know, you can sell them, and that's great. You know, that's sort of a good feeling to do that.
We've been speaking with Lou Pignolet, and Lou lives in Hovland now. He's retired, and he's become an amazing artist, picking up work with wooden bowls, lathe-turned wooden bowls, and not only that, but very artistic new designs and methods that he's perfected over the last few years. Luke, one more time, if people Google Bark Bowls,
yep.
your name will come
yeah,
up.
Yeah, Bark-Edged Bowls.
And also you yeah. can go to North House Folk School to learn when he's mm-hmm. when and where he's teaching his right. next classes.
Yeah. One other thing I can add, I do have bowls on display in Duluth at the New Scenic yeah. Cafe. I always have about 15 bowls there where they can be purchased or just look at as you're mm-hmm. eating. It's a great restaurant,
yeah.
too.
Great. Yeah, and that's on the scenic route between Duluth and Two Harbors.
Yes.
Yes. Lou, I want to thank you so much for joining us here tonight. It's been great to have you aboard. And now we'll let you get back to your shop and get okay. into the zone.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great.